He belonged in uniform. His country was at war. He was 36 years old and bursting with vitality. Before going to work in the morning at the Navy Department, he often played a round of golf. On weekends, he rarely got in less than 36 holes. During the week, he worked out with Walter Camp, the football coach and fitness enthusiast. Lathrop Brown, his Harvard roommate, was serving in the new tank corps. Harry Hooker, his former law partner, was now Major Hooker, on the staff of the 53rd Division American Expeditionary Forces. Another law partner and Harvard pal, Langdon Marvin, was driving an ambulance in France with the Red Cross. His four distant cousins, Archibald, Kermit, Theodore Jr., and Quentin, sons of Franklin's idol, former President Theodore Roosevelt, had all enlisted. The exploits of TR's boys filled the newspapers, arousing in Franklin competing emotions of pride and envy. Even his nearsighted brother-in-law, Hall Roosevelt, had volunteered. On the very day that war had been declared, April 6, 1917, the Roosevelt clan gathered at the home of TR's married daughter, Alice Roosevelt Longworth. There, the former commander-in-chief seized Franklin by the shoulders, fixed him with his myopic gaze, and pleaded with him to resign as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. "You must get into uniform at once," TR urged. "You must get in." Franklin was all too willing. Patriotism was the main reason, but politics intruded as well. In 1898, when America had gone to war against Spain over Cuba, TR had resigned from the very Navy post Franklin now held. He had formed his own regiment, the Rough Riders. He had worn the uniform, known war, and subsequently reached the political pinnacle. TR's trajectory was not lost on his ambitious young relative. Franklin's chief, Navy Secretary Josephus Daniels, easily detected the parallels. Theodore left the position of Assistant Secretary to become a Rough Rider, later Governor of New York and then President, and both had served in the legislature of New York, Daniels noted. Franklin actually thought fighting in the war was the necessary step toward reaching the White House. Franklin's mother, Sarah, had recently written her son, "The papers say buttons and pictures of you are being prepared to run for governor." But Franklin preferred to take TR's route, military service first. Theodore Roosevelt, now 59, blind in one eye, partially deaf, his body racked by punishing expeditions into the disease-infested Brazilian jungle, was itching to answer his country's call again. He hoped to raise a volunteer division, just as he had raised a regiment in the earlier war. He pleaded with Franklin to get him an appointment with President Woodrow Wilson. This request could prove ticklish. Ever since TR, as a third-party candidate, had been beaten by Wilson 5 years before in the 1912 presidential election, he had been lambasting the winner for everything from woolly-headedness to cowardice for not getting America into the European war sooner. Nevertheless, the day after the Roosevelt gathering at Cousin Alice's house, Franklin did go to the Secretary of War, Newton Baker, and persuade him to intervene with Wilson on TR's behalf. The president would later say of meeting with his old foe, "I was charmed by his personality. You can't resist the man." Evidently, he was able to resist, since he told Baker afterward, "I really think the best way to treat Mr. Roosevelt is to take no notice of him." TR was baffled by Wilson's failure to seize upon his heartfelt offer. As he left the White House with Wilson's confidant, Colonel Edward M. House, he complained, "I don't understand. After all, I'm only asking to be allowed to die." To which House reportedly responded, "Oh, did you make that point quite clear to the president?" Uncle Ted had not made it back into uniform himself, but his admonition still echoed in Franklin's ear. "I should be ashamed of my sons if they shirked war." After TR's White House visit, Franklin did submit his resignation as Assistant Secretary in order to enlist. But when the letter landed on Wilson's desk, the president rejected what he considered military romanticism. He told Secretary Daniels to inform his subordinate that he was no different from any draftee. "Neither you nor I nor Franklin Roosevelt has the right to select the place of service," he warned. "Tell the young man to stay where he is." Unfazed, Roosevelt next went to Wilson personally, only to be turned down again. The rejection, nevertheless, did illuminate Roosevelt's rising star. Wilson's former Army Chief of Staff, General Leonard Wood, observed that Franklin Roosevelt should under no circumstances think of leaving the Navy Department. That would amount to a public calamity. The real power in the U.S. Navy, Wood believed, was not Secretary Daniels, but his aggressive deputy. As the country entered its 15th month of the war, a still frustrated Franklin managed to wangle an assignment that lifted him, if not exactly to combatant status, at least to something more than a desk-bound civilian. He urged Secretary Daniels to allow him to go to Europe, to look into our naval administration in order to work more closely with the other services. The essentially pacifist Daniels felt no necessity himself to witness the bloodletting firsthand, and eventually yielded to Franklin's ceaseless importuning, even allowing his assistant to write his own orders, essentially a blank check to pursue such other purposes as may be deemed expedient upon your arrival. Franklin confided to his wife that he had been promised a commission as a Navy lieutenant commander upon his return. Before leaving, he sent President Wilson a letter, saying he hoped the speculation about his running for governor of New York would end. He was not going to give up war work for what is frankly very much a local political job in these times.